Faith Seeking Understanding. It could cover almost anything. So rather than leave you too much in suspense, let me tell you roughly what I'd like to be talking about this morning and this afternoon. And basically this morning, I'd like to start by thinking about the very categories we're using, about faith and understanding, to think with you a little bit about the nature of knowing and reasoning itself. That will take me into some fairly diverse fields, and I hope it'll hang together more or less. But it does seem to me that one of the problems we have in talking in these terms is that often we start by thinking we know what we mean by faith, understanding, reasoning, believing, and as often as not, we don't know very well, and it doesn't do us any harm to step back and ask how we are using such words. But one of the points which I hope will emerge in this morning's reflection and give a bit of a bridge to later on is that the understanding we're looking for is less an understanding of concepts and schemes and more an understanding of patterns emerging in certain kinds of life. And this afternoon I want to talk about some lives that might flesh out the generalities I'm approaching this morning. In other words, this afternoon I want to be looking at what some contemporary lives of faith look like and what they might suggest to us. But let's try to get the abstract bit out of the way first. When St. Anselm first talked about faith seeking understanding, the words he used, fides and intellectus in Latin, didn't mean quite what we might mean by them today. Faith certainly didn't mean a rather second-rate and unreasonable kind of conviction. And intellect certainly didn't mean the sort of thing that university teachers do. Faith was still, at that point, an act of trust rather than inspired guesswork. And there's a very interesting moment about 100 years after Anselm, no, a little bit less than that, about 50 years after Anselm, where St. Bernard got involved in a debate with Peter Abelard in France. And part of the debate was about the definition of faith. Now, this is slightly surprising, because St. Bernard is often cast, when people know anything about this debate, St. Bernard is usually cast as the villain of the piece. He's the sort of clerical hitman, and Peter Abelard is the bold young radical. As a matter of fact, Peter Abelard was about 20 years older than St. Bernard, and the discussion about faith rather turns on its head some of what you might expect. Bernard says, the trouble with Abelard's notion of faith is that it's too much in the head. Peter Abelard, says St. Bernard, treats faith as if it were precisely inspired guesswork. He uses the Latin word estimatio. Faith is a mental figuring of the map, which you guess at and you think, yeah, that more or less makes sense. And Bernard wants to say, faith is not guesswork. It's not primarily something to do with mapping your intellectual territory. It's something which is a habit of the heart, a habit of trust, a skill of seeing, a skill of vision. It includes reason rather than being opposed to it. Now, Bernard then, of course, does rather spoil the argument by invoking all the powers of the church to get rid of Abelard, but that's another story. The point I'm making, though, is that I actually think Bernard was right in that debate rather than Abelard, or rather Bernard had got something that Abelard had missed. And that helps us understand what the faith is that St. Anselm's talking about. Anselm begins from believing that faith is a disposition, an attitude of the whole person. An attitude of trust, an attitude of commitment, which connects you to a life-giving reality. That's where we all start, for Anselm. We start in worship, we start in prayer, we start in repentance, we start with the hard work of self-knowledge, very important for both St. Anselm and St. Bernard. And all of that is bound up in faith. So when St. Anselm starts on this question of faith-seeking understanding, what he means is something like this. Here we are with these habits of the heart and the mind, these habits of self-questioning, these habits of adoration towards the mystery of God. How does that actually dovetail with particular bits of our human operation, especially the bit called intellectus, that is, penetrating into things by means of ideas? And so he demonstrates, to his satisfaction, though nobody very much is since then, that the very act of thinking about God presupposes the reality of God. And I won't go into the details of that, because it's driven better minds than mine round the twist over the centuries. But the point is, as I say, a holistic beginning, a habit, a disposition, taking up a stance towards the reality which is trustful, receptive, puzzled, but celebratory altogether. And I think as a characterization of faith, that might be something to work with. You know, receptive, puzzled, celebratory, and trustful. And in that original context, it's that attitude, that disposition, that is looking for ways of talking about itself that will more or less hang together. I begin with that bit of history partly to break down the rather artificial distinctions that sometimes bedevil discussions about faith and reason and understanding. At least since the 17th century, we've been encouraged to think something like this, that faith is unreasonable conviction, and knowledge is reasonable conviction. Faith is a bit sort of arbitrary, and it exists in the absence of evidence and certainty and the ordinary things that we work with. Knowledge is the real thing. Knowledge is actually having a good grid by which to map the world based on evidence, based on the hard stuff. And it's taken quite a few centuries for that to break down. And some of what's broken it down, I would say, in the last perhaps 50 to 60 years, especially in the world of philosophy and science, what's broken it down has been a rather explosive mixture of philosophical reasoning and scientific advance. It's odd to think that scientific advance itself breaks down some of the myths about scientific knowledge that people have worked with. But that, I think, is exactly what's been happening. So let me next pause a bit on that question. What's been happening to what people think and say about knowing and understanding? Certainly in the last few decades, people have become increasingly aware that the model most of us grew up with, and a lot of people still internalize very readily about knowledge, is a very narrow and a very question-begging one. We've inherited this view that the human subject, as a subject of knowledge, is a little bit like a lighthouse casting its beam around. It lights up a subject, it fixes on it, it gets the best picture it can, it takes the photograph and stores it away. It has, in some way, encompassed what is there and taken it in, filed and docketed. It's connected with solving problems, because, of course, if you have all the requisite bits of information, then you know how to solve problems, don't you? Look at the world around. It's perfectly obvious we know how to solve problems. And it works by very carefully defining the sorts of question it can deal with and then producing the answers to them. So behind that are at least two very interesting and rather problematic notions. The first is that I am, above anything else, a mind that works by evidence and conclusions. And secondly, it assumes that the world can be, as I put it, mapped on a grid where relevant bits of information, relevant conclusions, and all the rest of it are carefully laid out so that I know how to find the evidence that will make me solve the problem. These are two of the things that have broken down. And they've broken down in this sort of way. First of all, there's that notion of the self and the mind. Western civilization has woken up rather belatedly to the fact that minds don't just live in midair. And in all kinds of ways, whether they're to do with politics, with the radical new awareness of gender in the last few decades, or whatever it may be, the bodiliness of human knowing has come to be rather more important. I don't just know ideas, I know stuff. Or rather, I am in touch with stuff. I am shaped by a material environment of which I am part. I first learn to make pictures and ideas of the world by the experience as a child of bumping into stuff. I map the world in terms of the things I bump into. I learn, first of all, to find my way around. And in finding my way around, I bring into my mind, pictures of what's there, maps of what's there, that are deeply connected with the fact that I'm moving around as a body. Learning how to make concepts and ideas about the world has a great deal more to do than we might think with feeling the grain of the world, feeling our way around. And although it's a blindingly obvious thing to say, it did take until about the 1940s for any philosopher to say it with any conviction. I don't see things in three dimensions. I see a particular set of phenomena, which I then have to fill out by imagination. I can't see the backs of your heads, but I'm assuming that they're there. I'm assuming that what's in front of me is, in fact, a context with depth, in every sense, of course. But I construct for myself, I sense with my body and with my imagination, all working together, a wholeness of view, which I never at any one point can just put in front of me. To see the back of your head, I have to walk round you. Walking round you takes time. To see you whole takes time. To see a material world takes time. I have to give myself time in order to know, because my knowing is bound up with being a body. Now, all of that may seem blindingly obvious, but I have to say it wasn't blindingly obvious for an awful lot of very clever people for a very long time. And one of the most interesting shifts in the philosophy of the 20th century is a deeper and deeper awareness of that bodily dimension to what it means to knowing. And although I doubt whether many people will rush off and buy this at the station bookstall, there's a rather terrifying French book of the mid-century by Maurice Merleau-Ponty called The Phenomenology of Perception, which, although, as I say, it may not actually be on anyone's top 10 reading list, is a brilliant evocation of what it means to know as a body, to realize that you know with your hands and your feet and your nose, as well as with whatever goes on inside your cerebellum. So there's been a bit of a breakdown there in terms of thinking about our knowing and our bodies. And of course, connected with that, an awareness that when I say I know something, what I'm actually doing when I present a proposition that I know is boiling down a quite full and quite complicated history into a short formula of words. If I say I know this particular state of affairs, I'm not saying that I have, back to the old image, fixed it in the beam and photographed it with the flash of my intellect. I'm saying, well, here's the deposit of a process that my body has been through. which, for practical purposes, I'll sum up like this. And summing it up like this enables me to solve a certain number of problems and to clarify a certain number of obscurities. But what it doesn't mean is that I've got it. If my knowledge really is involved with the life of the body, then I've never quite got it, because I'm always still in the process of finding my way around, feeling my way around in every sense, and that makes a difference. So it does seem as though that apparently simple, apparently obvious picture of knowing and understanding is not quite so obvious or simple. Or rather, it is obvious and simple because, as soon as you say it, you know that's what you do. But mysteriously, immense amounts of intellectual energy have been devoted to making it more complicated and more unreal. And bizarre as it may sound, one of the effects of complicated mid-century philosophy has been to reconnect us with what actually we sort of knew anyway. But the damage has been done. And the damage is a kind of cultural default setting which assumes there is hard knowledge, which is scientific and problem-solving and clear and propositional, and there's fuzzy knowledge or soft knowledge, which is all the tiresome things like relationships, religion, art, and similar luxuries, which are somewhere down the scale from the real stuff. And it's surprising how deep that goes. One of the things I find most fascinating in the work of my friend and sparring partner Richard Dawkins is the way in which he can write with immense empathy, imagination, and excitement about the beauty and wonder of the processes he discusses, and then produce a view of knowledge which is basically 17th century. Still to do with evidence, conclusions, solving problems, and all the rest of it. My respect for Richard depends rather more on the former than on the latter, and I have real respect. A respect for somebody who is able to talk about the natural world, its complexity and its excitement, in a way which very few modern scientists can do. But it's that second bit, what I call the 17th century bit, that seems to get into the bloodstream of quite a bit of our culture. And it's a story I've told more than once before, but it's probably worth recycling one more time, of a conversation with some sixth formers a few years ago about religion and science, where at one point, in some exasperation, I think, I said, "You have to remember, when we're talking about genetics, that there's no such thing as a gene." And there was a rather shocked response from the youngsters who said, "But of course there are things, there are genes, because we do genetics in school. We learn about genes and genetics." I said, "Yes, yes, yes. The point is, the word gene is a very helpful holding operation to give you a bit of traction on a rather complex set of processes by which information is transmitted from one container to another. They're not little blokes." And what I sometimes call the little bloke fallacy is very active in some kinds of science, alas. You know, we're made up of little blokes who, whether we call them atoms, genes, or whatever, they're all little things with purposes and adventures and dramas of their own. And I think that's a very, very strange picture of the world. But it's the result of mistaking how knowledge works, mistaking this holding operation. Well, okay, yeah, that's about the best we can do on the basis of the process we've been through, with some kind of fixing of objects and processes as if that were exactly what they were imprinted on our mind, like the photographic negative, hence the camera image. So part of what I think any discussion of faith and understanding ought to be doing in our contemporary culture is pushing back a bit and asking these questions. So what do we mean when we talk about knowledge? And when we privilege scientific knowledge, what are we working with? Are we supposing a model which is actually rather like that 17th century one, the photographic one, Or are we really looking for something a bit more interesting? Because most working scientists, with any sophistication at all, will, I think, recognize that the process by which science advances is a process that is physical, imaginative, inspired guesswork, testable guesswork, yes, of course, but always pushing at the edges and not simply assuming we've got it nailed down. And I can remember a discussion in my college in Cambridge a few months ago between one or two guests and a couple of young nuclear physicists in the college, where, perhaps unsurprisingly, the guests were talking about the certainties of science and the nuclear physicists were saying no, more or less every point, and inviting all of us to think again about what we thought knowing amounted to. Now, that leads to a couple of quite interesting conclusions in itself. I'll come back in a moment to some of the rest of the work that science is currently doing. But among the conclusions that might suggest is that what we mean by faith or belief is not the eccentric and rather shabby country cousin of real knowledge. And it's not some wild eccentricity that is indulged in by a few ethnic minorities. It's actually on a line of continuity about the way we relate to the world we're in. It's not in itself something so different that all bets are off and all rules are off. And part of what I want to say today is, of course, that works both ways. On the one hand, faith, the world of faith, can say to the world of knowledge, understanding, actually, knowledge is much more flexible, much more messy than you might imagine, and it's a bit more like faith than you might be comfortable in admitting. Equally, though, the scientist, the professor of knowledge as such, is in a very good position to say to the world of faith, don't suppose that faith, in order to be taken seriously, has to be like 17th century knowledge. A set of beliefs you pin down, nail down as exact representations of something out there. So this is a bit unsettling for both ends, and I think rightly so. And faith in search of understanding is, I would say, an enterprise in which both what we think of as faith and what we think of as understanding are going to take a little bit of revision on board. It is, isn't it, one of the great paradoxes of religious life in the last century and a half, maybe, that so many religious believers have thought that in order to be taken seriously in a world of hard knowledge, faith must be propositional, exact, and certain. The paradox being that fundamentalism, which often presents itself as traditional Christianity, is a quintessentially modern phenomenon produced by reaction against what I would regard as a dangerously limited or distorted view of knowledge. As if just at the moment when scientists are finally saying, look, we need to think again about this knowledge business, some kinds of Christian fundamentalists are scrambling up into that position and say, look, look, we're certain. We can trump your certainty with our own. So that's a cultural fact that is worth bearing in mind. The modernity of fundamentalism is something that fascinates me as a theme, and I could talk a lot about that in Christian or in other contexts. But I would want to say that's the risk. It's looking for exactly the kind of certainty that sensible science is letting go of. Back to that later, perhaps, but it's important, I think, to know that to talk about faith and understanding in this way is not, as it were, to say to the world of science and objective knowledge triumphantly, you're not as good as you thought you were, and we've been right all along. It's rather to say, we've all got to do a bit of work on how material, exploratory, time-taking knowledge looks and works. And actually, I think St. Bernard would have been as upset by that as Abelard would have been. Now, a word about some more specific things in recent scientific and philosophical exploration which bear on this. And this is where I brandish before you this immense volume by Ian McGilchrist called The Master and His Emissary. Some of you may have come across this. I won't say it's a word-of-mouth bestseller, because it is, after all, 596 pages long and in very small print. But it's been interesting to see in the last 4 or 5 years how this work has cropped up again and again in theological and philosophical discussion. Ian McGilchrist is somebody trained in literary criticism, in neuroscience, and in psychology, which is quite a powerful combination. And it's a book about the two hemispheres of the brain. Now, most of us will be fairly familiar with the left brain, right brain breakdown as it works. You know, the left brain connected with the right side of the body, being the problem-solving, exact, focusing, analytic bit, and the right brain correspondingly working on the other side of the body, the more holistic and less precise element of our mental life. McGilchrist doesn't buy into a simple mythology of, you know, right brain good, left brain bad, or the two being non-communicative styles of working, or whatever else. The brain is one activity. But he does argue very strongly that in evolutionary terms, the right brain, which sees more than just the immediate problem, which has a sort of intuitive view of a whole picture, that's the one that does the heavy lifting in human development. That's the one that gives you contexts in which questions make sense. The bizarre thing, he says, that's happened in our culture over the last few centuries is that the left brain has almost entirely taken over. That's to say, the problem-solving, exactitude-obsessed, analytical brain has treated itself as the only thing that matters. And that may seem just a rather technical point at first, until you watch the breakdown that he offers of the effects of different social moments in modern history on actual people and actual policies. So he writes in the later chapters about what he calls the master betrayed. That is, what ought to be the leading bit of our mental activity, the imaginative connection-making element, being betrayed by that more functional servant, which is the analytic capacity. So let me just share with you a couple of things from McGilchrist's conclusions. Let's try to imagine what the world would look like if the left hemisphere became so far dominant that it managed more or less to suppress the right hemisphere's world altogether. Remember that left for these purposes is the right hand, as it were, the grasping, dominant, analytic thing. We could expect for a start there would be a loss of the broader picture, a substitution of a more narrowly focused, restricted but detailed view of the world, making it difficult to maintain a coherent overview. The broader picture would be disregarded. It would lack the appearance of clarity and certainty which the left hemisphere craves. In general, the bits of anything, the parts into which it could be disassembled, would come to seem more important, more likely to lead to knowledge and understanding than the whole, which would come to be seen as no more than the sum of the parts. Ever more narrowly focused attention would lead to an increasing specialization and technicalizing of knowledge. This in turn would promote the substitution of information and information gathering for knowledge, which comes through experience. Knowledge, in its turn, would seem more real than what one might call wisdom, which would seem too nebulous. One would expect the left hemisphere to keep doing refining experiments on detail, at which it is exceedingly proficient, but to be correspondingly blind to what is not clear or certain, or cannot be brought into focus right in the middle of the visual field. One would expect a sort of dismissive attitude to anything outside of its limited focus, because the right hemisphere's take on the whole picture would simply not be available to it. Well, he goes on in the pages that follow to explore further consequences, and essentially to ask at the end of that chapter, does that remind you of anything? Does that sound like a world you know? And the answer, of course, is yes. I won't try and summarize the very complex arguments from cultural history that go into this, the way in which he maps this onto the Romantic period and the Industrial Revolution and so forth. But just bring you back to that fundamental duality, which in a healthy brain works in convergence, and in an unhealthy brain works in imbalance. The convergent model assumes that large pictures, which depend quite a bit on intuition and imagination, are quite properly filled out, tested, extended, corrected by careful analytic work, which feeds back into bigger pictures. That's the convergent model. The imbalanced, divergent model is that one way of relating to the world, one way of knowing, is the way. There's real knowledge and there's wooziness. And increasingly, our culture depends on that divergent model, and it's very bad for us. It's bad for us in a whole number of ways. It's bad for us, not least, in our engagement with the actual world we inhabit. And in case that sounds a bit ambitious or speculative, I just refer you to what we have as a matter of bare fact done to our material environment in the last couple of hundred years. We have been focused again and again on solving particular problems for short-term goals. And we've been absolutely brilliant at solving particular problems in terms of short-term goals. We have increasingly lost any sense of ecology in its true meaning. Ecology, the logic, the rhythm, the pattern of the household we live in, the oikos, the house we inhabit, which is our material world. And having lost the logic of our household, the sense that we are part of a highly complex interaction of forces which we have to inhabit, not control, well, we see what that has done to us, is doing to us, and is going to go on doing to us for quite a bit longer, unless we are willing to take some unwelcome radical steps. That, again, is another and larger topic. But it's part of how McGilchrist and many others see the way in which false views of knowledge have contributed to an abuse of the world we're in. That's just one of the more dramatically visible effects of imbalance, dysfunction in our mental activity, our approach to knowing. There would be many others. And of course, before the obvious criticism is made, there are loads of things in the religious world in general and the Christian world in particular which have made some very unhappy Faustian pacts with this, because this view of knowledge has picked up on all the most unhealthy bits embedded here and there in Christian or Jewish or Muslim or other religious viewpoints. Suspicion of the body, an obsession with control, a fear of feeling, a fear of the material, the feminine, the uncontrollable, and all the rest of the fantasies that people have indulged. If you're a certain kind of slightly naive religious believer from a certain cultural background, then oddly enough, all of this stuff is unhappily congenial. And some of the problems we've seen are the result of that blend of the malfunction of religiousness and the malfunction of science together. And as I'll be suggesting a bit later on, that does mean that the answer to our problems is not just the affirmation of faith over against science. It's a renewed faithfulness and a renewed scientific edge which learn how to work together in inhabiting this world, this oikos, this household that we're in, real ecology. So, faith-seeking understanding becomes, I would say, not just a matter of how we get better religious ideas, you know, that's nice, but it's rather more, I would say, a matter of rethinking how, as people of faith and people of intelligence, we inhabit the world we're in, recognizing, as I've said, that on the analysis I've been offering, philosophical and scientific, faith is not an odd minority interest. It's one of the ways in which we are inhabiting and making sense of the environment we're in. A very recent book by Professor Graham Ward in Oxford, with the title Unbelievable, analyzes the notions of belief that are at work, once again, in the whole range of different human activities. And he makes very much the same point, that while we begin sometimes with this notion of belief as unreasonable and knowledge as reasonable, the fact is, from the word go, our intelligence and our imagination work together. Belief makes questions possible. Questions make belief credible, in a strange way. Questions, by testing and probing, give us some sense of how durable our commitments and our visions are, but without commitments and visions, we don't ask any questions whatsoever. So, where do we go with this in terms of thinking about our religious commitments? Let me offer just a few thoughts, which again I hope will imply a few bridges forward to discussion later in the day. I think that all of this obliges us to think very hard about faith as not simply a set of mental attitudes, you know, believing in the following propositions, but indeed, as St. Bernard and others would say, faith as a disposition, an orientation to the world, including a set of practices in the world. Faith is about doing stuff as well as thinking stuff. Indeed, neither doing nor thinking is an adequate characterization of what's going on. Learning how to feel your way around the world, which is what I said about knowledge itself, is also what faith is doing. And that means that faith is very closely bound to physical practices. What we do, both in terms of our own discipline, our own understanding of our bodies, and what we do with, to, for the bodies of others, becomes crucial to thinking about faith. And I guess that if you wanted some biblical foundation for that, both St. Paul and St. James in the New Testament, usually regarded as polar opposites, have some things to say about that. If Paul can think of faith very much in terms of the gifts of the Spirit, which are all about qualities of relation, and if St. James can say it's no good thinking that you've got the right ideas if you don't know how to behave towards the bodies of others, especially the poor, you know, you've missed it. Both of those understandings of faith, I think, correspond very much to some of what I'm trying to talk about. And one of the greatest successes of, well, let's be very mythological and say the devil, in the last couple of hundred years, has been again and again to make us think that faith is something that goes on inside your head, as opposed to being that general orientation embodied minute by minute in how you are actually relating to your environment, your own body, the bodies of others, the body of the world. There's a wonderful Canadian philosopher by the name of Philip Shepherd, who has, in the last few years, been writing quite a lot about this recovery of a new sense of self and body in philosophy and practice. And I owe a great deal to conversation with him in thinking through some of these issues. But it's one of those areas where it does help, particularly Western Christians of a certain kind. It does help us to look again at those forms of religious life which seem to us a bit thin in ideas and rather strong in rituals and practices. And to realize, well, it's not a simple standoff between superstition and enlightenment that's going on there. Many years ago, I remember when my wife and I were on holiday reading different books, we were comparing some of what we were reading. I was reading a book on Tibetan Buddhism, like you do. And a very powerful chapter on butter sculptures, which is, you know, something that Tibetan monks do for festivals. You make these elaborate sculptures out of butter. And also sand mandalas, you know, very complex paintings in different colored sands. And my wife was reading a book on ethics and philosophy, again, like you do on holiday. You must get the most awful picture of our domestic life. And as we talked about this, we both rather agreed that we were slightly more impressed by the butter sculptures than by some of the vaporing about ethics and theology in the other book, that there was something about the disciplined connectedness of the imagination with the world that was so profoundly impressive and life-giving. Butter sculptures and sand mandalas, yes, not all of us do that, but there's something about that that is as proper and as apt a response to our environment as nattering about values. And it may very well be that the practitioner of butter sculptures and sand mandalas will know rather more about how to approach the bodies of others than someone who just talks about values. Because that disciplined conduct of the body in the world, that painstaking attention to the physicality of things, a Tibetan monk would say that learning all that is part of learning the compassion that is the proper goal of all Buddhist practice. And there are obvious Christian analogues for that. Learning that attentive and time-taking approach to the world around. It is, I suppose, why in the Western monastic tradition too, manual labor has been as important as contemplation. If you become a monk or a nun, you don't do so just to go to church. If you like going to church a lot, there are probably other ways of doing it. You become a monk or a nun in order that your personal relations and your relation to your work, your environment, the stuff around you, is all pervaded by a particular kind of patience, a particular kind of taking time. And the attention you give to doing the weeding in the monastery garden is part of the attention you give to the person next to you in the dining room, and the attention you give to the guest who comes knocking on the door asking for help and support. It's seamless in a properly conducted monastic life. And understanding that faith looks like that, it doesn't just look like people with eccentric views about the world, that may get us over a little bit of a hump in thinking about faith and understanding. Because it connects faith, and I think this is quite a key point, it connects faith very closely to understanding what we are. That is an intellectus, an interior apprehension of what it is to be human. Now this is again a bit of a bridge to things I want to talk about a little later in the day, and perhaps helps us to understand therefore why talking about narrative and particular stories is important. But I think this has to do with, I suppose, the distinctiveness of the human itself. To be human is to be involved in wondering about what it is to be human. It sounds a bit, you know, a bit self-conscious, a formulation like that, but I do think there's a lot in it. To be human is to be involved in wondering what it's like to be human. And the most interesting and searching, difficult questions we have, the most interesting disagreements we have, are about just that. Most of our big moral questions are not just about is this or that right or wrong. It's about what kind of humanity are we trying to nourish and develop around us. And that's where faith is indeed part of understanding, just as much as understanding is part of faith. Faith is part of the project of understanding. Going back to McGilchrist, without, and indeed Graham Ward, without the framing imagination, we can't even begin to ask the questions. Now, our society at the moment, and our world at the moment, is torn apart by any number of hideous clashes around what it is to be human, what a good life looks like. And where it's not torn apart by those clashes, it's marked by a painful and embarrassing deafness and ignoring of the question of what it is to be human. In the politics of this country at the moment, we throw around any number of easy formulae, and we seem very reluctant to step back and say, well, what would a good human life look like? What does a life well lived look like? We are indeed the prisoners of left brain approaches. Problem after problem after problem after problem. And where do we find the forum in which we ask, yes, but what does a good life look like? Here's a problem, find the cause, eradicate it. Here's a difficulty about poverty, welfare, migration, find the problem, focus in, eradicate the problem, move on. But what might it be to understand how the problem is rooted in issues over what we think a good life is? How do we make that connection? How do we avoid that isolating and atomizing understanding of where we are? And I'm intrigued by the fact that in the last couple of years, so many books have come out from very different quarters, from people who have no particular religious axe to grind, saying with increasing frustration, where's the forum where we talk about these things? Robert and Edward Skidelsky's wonderful book, How Much is Enough?, challenging the philosophy of unlimited growth as a self-evident good. Michael Sandel's book from the States, What Money Can't Buy, which lays out with painful clarity the ways in which so much of life has been commodified, turned into things we can exchange for cash. David Marquand's book a little while ago, Mammon's Kingdom, subtitled Britain Now. And quite a few others, all of them pushing away at this. How do we get to a discussion about what is due to human beings as such, what is the distinctive gift and splendor of human beings as such? How do we reframe some of our narrow notions in that context? So, faith in search of understanding, I would submit, is about far more than just religion as a minority activity. If it's about pressing some of these questions, what is it to know, what is it to believe? It's ultimately pressing questions about what is it to be human. And we need various kinds of forum in which those questions can be aired and can be pursued. And that's why I think that those who are concerned with the future of faith in our society, and I put it as generally as that, those of us concerned with the future of faith in our society have an obligation, as well as a capacity, to press some of these issues in whatever context it's possible to do so. And that's why I'm very glad that a day like this gives us an opportunity to air some of these things, broaden out the discussion, and rather than just ask the question of how do we deal with a few problems about Christianity, think also about the quality, the character of faith itself in this culture where the left brain looks as if it's winning, and where the consequences of the left brain winning are not very good news for anybody or anything. But just to move towards a sort of conclusion for now, if all that I've said is anything like on target, then, of course, when we are asked to talk about faith and what it means, we shall need not just systems, not just formulations, we shall need narratives. We need to be able to tell the story of how it is that people have come to know, to tell the story of how people have moved into understanding or wisdom. Stories of faith that are manifestly stories of growth and of discovery. When I'm asked, as I sometimes am on school visits and things like that, where would you start in explaining religion to somebody who wasn't religious? The only answer I can ever come up with is, well, I'd try and find an appropriate story of somebody who seems to me to live it out. Not just because that's a good example, and you ought to follow that example, but to say, if you want to understand how faith works, then you need to see it working in someone. You need to see it unfolding in a life. We have, of course, a calendar of saints in the church. I occasionally wonder whether we ought to have a calendar of sinners. Meaning by that, as it were, a list of people who are not shining examples of having got it all sorted, not that saints are that, of course, but people whose lives show in a particularly focused way what it is to discover, to move on, to move into understanding. And they may or may not be saints in the conventional sense, but they will show what faith is about. And I want this afternoon to talk about some of the stories that work for me in that particular connection. Well, I apologize for the abstract nature of a lot of what I've been talking about. I do realize there's been a lot of philosophy and a certain amount of rather badly digested science, but I hope some of it at least has made a little bit of sense. And to finish with, let's just go back to the most basic issues of all here. The world we're in, the world we inhabit, the world of which we are part, simply does not lend itself to reduction, to formulae, to problem solving. The very language we use is always doing strange things. Our language, which on one showing ought to be just a set of tidy labels for the stuff that's out there, our language involves songs, poems, jokes, puzzles. Our language pushes beyond the obvious boundaries and does new and strange things. New and strange things. And last year I was trying to work out some of the implications of that in some lectures in Edinburgh that have just been published. And that means that there's something about our being in the world which always is characterized by extravagance, excess. We say more than we need to say. We think more than we need to think. And while you might imagine that the evolution of the human race starts with simplicity and moves to complexity, actually it looks like the other way around. We might think that the inhabitants of Neolithic caves had No conversation whatever, except to say, pass me the axe. What we see, and some of you may remember the wonderful exhibition of Ice Age Art that was on in London last year, what we see is that as human, distinctive human presence emerges in the world with signs of consciousness and language and tool-making and so forth, as soon as you have tools and consciousness, you have imagination. No sooner do you have an axe than you have a decorated axe. You have an axe that looks like a reindeer. You don't start with the simple problem-solving. You start with something that is a flare of imagination. And I must say, the art of the Ice Age, as depicted in that exhibition from up to 30,000 years ago, is exhilarating. It shows that those people in the Neolithic caves or wherever were not just saying, hand me the axe. They were thinking, how do I represent a reindeer? How do I represent an ox, a bull? How do I produce a quite new thing, which is, there are several examples of this, a being with the head of a lion and the body of a man? Wouldn't that be interesting, to put lions and people together? So, around those cave fires in the Ice Age, a lot was going on. Our humanity begins with that interesting complexity, that doing more than you need to do. It reorders, it reimagines the world it's in, and that's our human history. And so far from history going from simplicity to complexity, it's almost as though it goes from complexity to simplicity. We're getting more and more simple and more simple-minded. And we're forgetting how to make axes that look like reindeer, metaphorically speaking. We're forgetting the excess. And that's why one last quote from a French philosopher. This is a man called Stanislas Breton. Philosophy and mysticism alike emerge from an original excess of which modern forms of knowledge have no notion. No discourse is capable of being adequate. All discourses can correct and complete one another in the endless search for the origin, the beginning, and the end of philosophy and mysticism alike. Faith and understanding belong together in that world of excess. Doing, thinking, feeling, imagining more than we need to. Moving out from the narrowness of problem-solving and reproducing what's out there in here into that active, material reworking of where we are. And faith is not an eccentric little bit of the human spectrum. In that sense, it's the clue to a great deal of how it works and can work and should work and indeed must work if we're going to go on being human in a meaningful way rather than wrecking both our humanity and the household in which we live in this world and this universe. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for that. Very profound, thank you. Now is the time for our faith to show that everything matters when you get your tea and coffee. And how we do that, because we need some military precision to make that happen. So we have two double doors open up there. We want everyone to go in through those two double doors, get their tea and coffee, and not stay in the lounge, but go out the two side doors. And we do have two marshals there, John being one of them, who's coming this way, and Anne as well. We will do that in a friendly manner, but we really don't want people hanging about in the lounge. So please enjoy your coffee and mull over what we've heard so that you have questions after the break. Thank you very much. Did you want...